From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters, and it is Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We'll get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this last week. There's a lot to get to, so let me introduce our panel. Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Caitlin Hart with East Idaho News, and Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter for the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Okay, we are 11 days out from Election Day. I mean, who's counting? I would be. And that means November 8th is Election Day, and there's a lot to break down today. But first, Clark, I want to start with absentee ballots because there's a big deadline today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Gemma, and thanks so much for taking the time to kind of highlight the upcoming November 8th election and some of the races and some of the ways that that folks can get prepared and make their plan to vote, because that's what's important. But it's a major election in Idaho. It's a major election across the country that's going to shape our government and politics for years. And today, if you're catching this live on October 28th, today is the last day in Idaho for registered voters to request an absentee ballot. You have until 5 o'clock today on October 28th to request that absentee ballot. There's two easy ways you can do that. You can go to the Idaho Secretary of State's website. Real easy to remember. It's voteidaho.gov, voteidaho.gov. Or you can go to your local county clerk's office or county elections office and request an absentee ballot. But I've talked with a couple of election clerks in a couple of different counties, and they're saying that there's a lot of interest in absentee voting right now with this upcoming election. In Canyon County, I spoke with the clerk, Chris Yamamoto, and he's actually encouraging folks to vote absentee for a number of different reasons. One of them is to cut down on potential wait time at the polls on election day itself on November 8th. Another, when I talked to the elections clerk, they talked about how absentee voting is a way for folks, if they would like it, to be able to spend more time with their ballot. You can do it at home, at your convenience. You can be looking up the issues and have your research right in front of you and take the time with that ballot rather than worrying about, you know, maybe I'm on my lunch break and I need to get back to work, or I need to pick up the children or get on with my day. And so if you do request that absentee ballot by today, if you're a registered voter, you'll have the time to spend with that ballot. But I do want to let folks know that if they request that absentee ballot, once they receive it in the mail, they're going to want to get on it right away, because those actually need to be received by the county clerk's office at the time polls close, which is going to be 8 p.m. local time all across the state on November 8th. It's not good enough to drop it in the mail on election day or a day before election day. It actually needs to be in the possession of the county elections officials by the time that polls close. And so today, October 28th, is the deadline to request that absentee ballot for registered voters. And then they want to make sure that they fill that out and submit it so that it can be received by November 8th. But if you're listening today and you're not able to request an absentee ballot, there's still other options for you to vote, including early voting, which is going on right now in Ada and Canyon counties and several counties across the state. That's going to continue until next week. That's an option. And of course, there's always the traditional in-person voting at the polls on election day itself. Polls are going to be open across the state local time, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. on election day. If you're not yet registered to vote, you can register at your polling place when you go to cast your ballot. So we're getting closer and closer to the election. I'm excited to kind of talk about some of the issues, but today is an important deadline for absentee balloting. And we know just across the country, a lot of voters are interested in absentee balloting. I saw a report from our parent organization at States Newsroom said something like 9 million voters have already voted as of earlier this week. So it's really popular. There's still time to do it in Idaho. But if you miss today's deadline, you can still vote early all next week. And you can obviously vote in person at the polls on Election Day. Again, Election Day is November 8th this year.
And Scott, I want to talk a little bit about the constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot. Can you fill us in about what this is?
Yeah, this is an amendment to the Constitution. It'll appear on your ballot as Senate Joint Resolution 102 or SJR 102. And this is essentially the legislature is asking voters for permission to allow themselves to call themselves back into special session. Currently, Idaho is one of, I think, 14 states that only the governor can call the legislature back into a special session. And we just saw that happen in September, where Governor Little called the legislature back into a session, a one-day session to pass education funding and tax cuts and tax rebates. And so that is the only mechanism that we have in Idaho. And if this constitutional amendment passes, and it requires just a majority, so just 50% plus one on November 8th, if it passes, it would allow the legislators to call themselves back into a session for whatever reason they so choose, and whenever they choose, they can call themselves back in right after they adjourn or later, 2 weeks before the election. But it requires 60% of legislators to make that call. So there's been a lot of discussion about whether this is a power grab by the legislature or whether this is just balancing the power between the executive and the legislative branches. Obviously, what we've seen in other parts of the country, Utah just passed, recently passed an amendment to their constitution that allows their legislature to call themselves back into session. They've met many, many times. They've called themselves back into session many times. And a lot of people are fearful that the legislature will become a full-time legislature if they do that, if they have that power, that they'll just call themselves back anytime they like. We'll have an endorsement coming up, whether voters should vote for that or not, coming up in Sunday's paper and online at idahostatesman.com.
I think Scott did a really good job of setting this up. And I think this is one of the more interesting things on the ballot. And it maybe hasn't got as much attention, Gemma and Scott, as some of the other issues. But this really dates back to 2020, the beginning of the pandemic, when the legislature, when Republicans in the legislature were clashing with Governor Brad Little over some of the COVID-19 safety precautions and restrictions that had been in place at the time. And so that's where that came from. It originated during the 2020 session. This is something that the Republicans in the legislature are pushing for. That's really the motivation behind this. And, we have heard a lot from Republicans in the legislature talking about wanting to protect their authority and not wanting to take a backseat to the executive branch of government, which is, of course, the governor's office and Governor Brad Little. And so it would be a big change if voters approve this. But like Scott said, right now, the governor does have the ability to call the special session. And I think we've had two special sessions in the last 3 years. We had one in 2020, and then we had another one just on September 1st of this year. And then the 2021 legislative session was really, really weird because the House refused to adjourn. And then we had that crazy situation where it was the longest legislative session in state history, marked by these long recesses and delays. And so I think the kind of two sides of the coin are concern about whether if this passed, the legislature would become more of a full-time year-round legislature, which is very different than the system we have today. But on the other hand, Idaho is a very conservative state. And if conservative voters trust their legislature, maybe they would be willing to go along with this and give them that ability, with the legislature saying, there's times where maybe we do need to come back in session, because the regular sessions happen every year. And as we remember, those are generally from like January to late March or early April during a traditional legislative session, although there's no time limit on how long those go. But I think this may be one of the most interesting issues on the ballot in Idaho, and I'm not sure how it's going to go, to be honest.
Right. I think it will be very interesting to see how all of this plays out. We'll get back to elections in a little bit further in the show, because there's still a lot to get to. But I want to bring Caitlin into the conversation, and let's head over to East Idaho. Caitlin, what in the world is going on in Bingham County, in particular at the coroner's office?
There are some pretty crazy things going on in Blackfoot right now. So last week we learned that the Bingham County coroner over there actually was accused of grabbing a woman's breast in Ada County in April. And because of these allegations, all three deputy coroners over in Bingham County have submitted letters of resignation, which will take effect on November 10th, which kind of just eliminates that whole department down there for the time being. Some of them have said that once he resigns and he's officially out, they will come back. But as of right now, it's kind of up in the air.
Okay, but all three of the deputy coroners have resigned. So Caitlin, who's running the office, and how are autopsies and things like that being performed?
That's a great question. As of right now, I believe they're not able to do them. And so right now, I think everything's kind of pushed to other counties. I would have to check on the specifics of that, but it's gotten pretty crazy. There was even a recording that was sent to us by one of the deputy coroners, the chief deputy coroner, in fact, where she recorded the coroner talking about the fact that he doesn't remember doing that and that he's sorry he put everybody in this position. And everybody has called for him to step down. The Bingham County commissioners, the prosecutor, sheriff, the clerk, the treasurer, and the assessor, they've all called for him to step down. And so far, we haven't heard anything, but we'll keep checking. And it's a pretty crazy story.
It is. And I'm sure you will stay on top of it. Nicole, so I was shocked to realize it has been just a few days, more than 1 year, since the Boise Town Square Mall shooting. I know the Idaho Statesman has done some reporting on this, of course, during the last year, but recently as well. So fill us in on kind of what has been learned from this tragedy that happened.
Yeah, Gemma. So Tuesday, the 25th, was actually the 1 year anniversary of that shooting. Two people were killed at the Boise Town Square Mall, so a security guard and then a man who was shopping at the Macy's store there. And of course, the shooter died by suicide that day as well. So we got a police report from the Boise Police Department a couple of weeks ago, probably about a month ago now. And it was a huge document, more than 400 pages of all kinds of accounts. Some information still pretty heavily redacted in there, though. But basically, we've learned quite a bit. And we kind of, at the Statesman, Ian Stevenson published a great story on Tuesday where he was able to include a lot of the witness accounts that we didn't really have previously about what happened at the mall and the surrounding area, really. So we were able to talk to someone who was working at Mod Pizza at the time, which was near where the shooter ran. After he fired shots at the mall, we were able to include some folks at the mall who were injured by passing bullets, some folks who later found bullet holes in their clothing but were not injured. So we got kind of a sense of how many shots were fired, how many people were impacted, and yeah, just how far-reaching this incident was. And then from that report, you know, that we've had several stories come out of that, but some really interesting information just about how long the shooter had been in this community. We included some information about, you know, where he had previously worked and spent time, and how he was kind of advocating for himself to be allowed to own firearms, which interestingly, Scott can speak on this, but we had been told since last year, the shooter's name was Jacob Bergquist. He had a felony in Illinois for theft, but it's not a felony that transfers over to Idaho for someone to permanently or continue to have their right to own firearms taken away. So he believed that he was legally allowed to own firearms here, and most officials believe that as well. We were told that by the prosecutor's office, but Scott has some great information from ATF that hopefully he can kind of dive into.
Yeah, Scott, I want to bring you into the conversation and talk about this because I read your article this morning. And, you know, as Nicole mentioned, I mean, and we all knew this last year, right, about this conviction in Illinois. This came out shortly after the shooting, and there were questions about federal law versus state law. But fill us in on your conversations with, as Nicole mentioned, you talked with the ATF.
Right. They emailed me a statement. They wouldn't answer questions, but they did email me a statement. And in that statement, they did confirm that indeed it was determined that Jacob Bergquist was prohibited from possessing firearms under federal gun laws. But that was only confirmed by the ATF after the Boise shooting had occurred. The like Nicole pointed out, the question is whether he was allowed to carry firearms under state law. And indeed, that felony of theft is not on the list of felonies that prohibit someone from carrying a firearm in Idaho. There are other crimes and other felonies that someone's convicted of that would preclude them from possessing a firearm. But this theft out of Illinois was a punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison. And anybody who's convicted of a felony that has a prison sentence of at least a year is precluded from, they're prohibited from possessing firearms under federal law. So when Meridian Police, Idaho State Police, Boise Police came into contact with Jacob Bergquist multiple times in the months before the Boise Mall shooting, they didn't do anything about it. They didn't arrest him. The Boise Police Department did investigate him and confirm some information, and they filed a report and forwarded that report to ATF on or around May 12th. We don't know exactly when ATF received that report, but the report was filed by Boise Police on May 12th, and that was the report that was forwarded to ATF. ATF spent the next 5-6 months investigating, getting lawyers involved, determining the felony that he was convicted of in Illinois. And then, like I said, after the shooting on October 25th, 2021, ATF determined that, yeah, he should not have had a firearm. And again, we've got warning signs here. And even after Boise Police forwarded their report to ATF, we know that Jacob Bergquist had come into contact with police at least 2 more times in the month of June, once at the Boise Mall and once at St. Alphonsus Hospital. And again, police were called out and nothing happened with him. He wasn't arrested because under Idaho law, he was not prohibited, but under federal law, he was prohibited. So there's a question, you know, where was the breakdown here? You know, did ATF act quickly enough to take action here, to investigate this and take action? Could Boise Police or Idaho State Police have intervened and arrested him on federal violation of federal gun laws? Where did Jacob Bergquist possess buy this firearm, this 9mm handgun that he had? Because if he had bought that through a federal license dealer, they would have done a background check on him, and he would have been prohibited from buying that firearm under federal laws. So still, you know, we're learning more. It's been a year, but I think there are still even more questions, and I think more lessons that should be learned. Because again, this is the kind of thing we need to prevent. We have the tools to prevent them. We have the laws to prevent them. But we're failing, and 2 people were dead and multiple people were injured.
You know, Scott, I always wonder when we come up with issues when it comes to federal law versus state law, right? And we I think most people realize federal law is supposed to supersede state law. With that said, you know, I wonder how much when we say, you know, well, law enforcement could have done this, law enforcement could have done that. I wonder how much training, though, sometimes goes into teaching law enforcement about, well, this is what state law says. However, this is what federal law says. Our law enforcement officers are not attorneys, right? They're not constitutional law experts, nor should they probably be. But I wonder if that's where some of the breakdown happens when we, you know, when we dig into all of this minutia, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, there are certain rights that are reserved to the states that the federal government does not supersede.
Right.
And you see it particularly with gun laws, that states are passing their own gun laws, whether to require permit for concealed carry, whether to drop the age down to 18. Federal law says 21. Some states like Texas, it drops down to 18. And someone explained it to me this way, that you look at, for example, marijuana laws. Marijuana is against the law, federal law. It's a Schedule I drug, yeah. Federally. But as we know, many states, 37 states, have passed legalized marijuana. So states do reserve some rights. But yeah, the question is whether law enforcement can work together, whether local and state police can work with federal agencies. Forwarding a report to the ATF, you know, that was probably the right thing to do. But in the end, it took 5-6 months to determine that he was prohibited and any action could have been done. And by then it was too late.
Right. Well, it took that long, Scott. And then, as you said, even in your article, it came to a head after two people lost their lives.
Right. Unfortunately. And how do we prevent these? You know, we talk about weapons bans, which I really do think is untenable. But keeping guns out of the hands of people who should not have guns, and Jacob Berquist should not have had a gun. He should not have had a gun, period. And how do we prevent this from happening again?
Right. Caitlin, we've spoken about this on the program before. There's a former sheriff in Eastern Idaho who pulled a gun on a group of teenagers. He was recently sentenced. Can you quickly give us, for folks who may not be familiar, what happened in that case, and then this sentencing?
Yeah, for sure. So in November of last year, Sheriff Rowland from Blackfoot pleaded guilty to, sorry, in November, he pulled a gun on a car that was carrying a group of Latter-day Saint youth group students and its group leader. There were a bunch of girls inside the car that were delivering thankful turkeys, which are basically just thank you notes that were written on paper that were cut to look like a turkey for mm-hmm. Thanksgiving. One of the turkeys was made for Sheriff Rowland's wife. So the little girls ran up to the door and taped it on the front door. Sheriff Rowland discovered the little turkey and he grabbed his gun and he went out into the street and stopped the car. He pointed his gun at the car and basically grabbed the driver, who was the only adult in the car. He grabbed her by the hair and held his gun to her head and basically threatened to shoot her before demanding that she left. And all of the girls were obviously traumatized and really scared in the car. And so he was recently sentenced to 3 years probation after accepting a plea agreement where he ended up pleading guilty to felony aggravated assault in exchange for them dismissing the felony aggravated battery and misdemeanor exhibition of a weapon charges. So basically, the lead deputy attorney general, Jeff Nye, talked about it. He said that it was a night of terror for the girls. And, you know, how can these girls trust anybody if they can't trust the sheriff? So he was able to get just probation from all of this.
And we should note too, Caitlin, if I'm remembering this correctly, that he was sheriff at the time of this incident, but he refused to step down. Didn't it take quite a while before he even would step down? But because of the charges against him, I mean, he couldn't even carry a firearm.
It did take quite a bit of time for him to accept responsibility. So originally, there were rumors that he was drunk or on drugs, and he denied all of this in the beginning, saying that he just was reacting to a car he didn't know in his neighborhood. You know, he claimed that he didn't do anything wrong and that these court proceedings were just a vote grab for the attorney general's office and a money grab for the kids in the car and the woman driving. And so he actually ended up writing an apology letter in August, which basically said that he is accepting responsibility and he made a series of decisions that will likely define the law enforcement, his legacy, basically. So it took almost a year. The event was in November 2021 and his letter came out in August 2022. So he did eventually resign and plead guilty, but it took quite a long time for that to happen.
And it will take quite a bit longer than 9 months, I'm sure, for the trauma to subside for the victims. Yeah. Okay. I want to go back to elections. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, we are 11 days out from the midterm. And let's start at the very top of the ticket with the race for governor. And Clark, we have got, I think it's safe to say, some unconventional challengers in this race.
Yeah, we absolutely do. And Jim, I'll invite you and Scott to jump in and as well and help me out here. But yes, looking at the governor's race, it's incumbent Republican Governor Brad Little against kind of a field of unconventional challengers this year. It's been an odd campaign. It's a quiet campaign. As we've talked about before, the governor didn't debate in either the primary or leading up to this general election. And that's an anomaly. The Idaho Press Club and the organizers of the debate said he's the first governor running for re-election to not participate in the statewide televised debates in something like 30 years. So it's a little bit of an anomaly, but just looking through the ballot, there's five people total on the ballot and then one write-in candidate. So your Republican incumbent is Governor Brad Little. The Democratic nominee is Stephen Height, a teacher from Marsing. We have independent Ammon Bundy, who originally registered as a, or originally said he was going to run as a Republican and then backed out of the Republican primary. And he's now running as an independent. There's a Constitution Party candidate named Shanti Rose Davison, a libertarian named Paul Sand, who's from Whitebird. And then Lisa Marie is running as a write-in candidate. She's a candidate who kind of habitually has run for office every 2 to 4 years over the last decade or so. So five people in the race, but it's been a super quiet race. You know, like I said, Governor Little hasn't debated. He hasn't done a ton of campaigning. I haven't seen a ton of ads. He's really not engaged with a traditional campaign in the way that you might think of a governor running for re-election. And so, you know, I think at this point, it's his race to lose. He's got the name recognition. He's been lieutenant governor before this. He was in the Idaho Senate before that, like his father. And, you know, the Democratic nominee, Stephen Height, really found himself in a position where he was surprised to be the only Democrat in the field going back to the May primary, because there were some paperwork issues with the perceived frontrunner, Sandpoint Mayor Shelby Rongstad, who was still registered as a Republican and was unable to run in the Democratic primary. And so Stephen Height was kind of surprised to find himself as the only Democrat in the race, and then obviously won the nomination that way. He faces a steep uphill climb, even by Idaho Democratic standards. He doesn't have a ton of name recognition. He hasn't held office before in the state of Idaho. He's actually run for Congress as a Republican in other states, and he's at a big disadvantage when it comes to political fundraising. When I talked to him a few weeks ago, he said the campaign had been a little slower than he expected, but he was hoping to pick it up in the home stretch leading up to the November 8th election. On the other hand, probably the most active candidate, I would say, at least that I'm seeing, is Ammon Bundy, the independent activist from Emmett. I think a lot of listeners and readers will remember that name, but he and his family have had clashes with state and federal law enforcement officers a number of times over the last 8 years. At one point, he was banned from the Idaho State Capitol building for repeatedly protesting COVID-19 restrictions at the Capitol and being arrested multiple times. So at one point, Ammon Bundy he was banned from the state Capitol, and he's running on a platform of repealing taxes, turning over federal lands back to the state of Idaho, and ending all exceptions to Idaho's near total abortion ban. But he's been raising money. He has a ton of social media campaign ads out there. He's doing a lot of town hall events and public appearances. And so it's interesting that the anti-government activist is running the most traditional campaign, I would say, out of the field. But it's an unusual race. And I think Scott might have a little bit more latitude to discuss the race and why it's unusual with his position as an editorial page writer and opinions page editor. But I'd be curious about Scott's thoughts on this race and maybe some insight that I overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like making predictions, but I think it would be safe to say that Little will likely win re-election. But what I'm going to be looking for the most is what percentage Ammon Bundy gets. Is it going to be 2% or 5%, or is it going to be more like 10 or 15% or 20%? Brad Little didn't have, a perfectly easy time in the primary, in the Republican mm-hmm. primary. And there were some extreme candidates who received quite a number of Republican votes. Now, how that translates into the general election remains to be seen. But like Clark said, Ammon Bundy is, from what I can tell, the most active campaign going on right now, with a lot of ads, video ads served up on YouTube and Facebook. And whether that gains traction on November 8th, we'll see. I don't think it would be enough to unseat the incumbent governor, but I'll be interested to see what percentage he ends up with.
Yeah. Let's talk about the lieutenant governor race as well, because there is no incumbent in this race. And Clark, something that struck me just yesterday in regards to this race is I happened to catch some ads on television for Scott Bedke. And the sound was down, but I'll tell you, if I had not known any different, I would have thought he was running against Joe Biden, because the whole entire ad was Bedke versus Biden. And it was a bit where I was like, well, he's the president. Why are you running an ad against the president? But I mean, it does go back to that kind of trying to show the difference in who he is versus who's in the White House right now.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And again, Scott can jump in here. But I think we've seen that a couple of examples of that in Idaho, where the Republicans are mentioning people like Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer in their ads, or they're talking about President Biden. And so, yeah, I think we've seen that in Scott Bedke's ads, and maybe in U.S. Senator Mike Crapo's ads a little bit. And I guess that's not super surprising. Idaho is a conservative state. The Republicans have held the legislature, since after 1990, and they've held the governor's office for more than 25 years. And so that's not surprising. But when we look at the lieutenant governor's race itself, I want to give a plug here, actually, because there is a debate tonight on Idaho Public Television that will also be streamed live on YouTube and then archived online, but 8 o'clock Mountain Time, 7 p.m. Pacific on Idaho Public Television and on their YouTube channel and website, there's going to be a debate between the two main candidates for lieutenant governor. That is Republican Speaker of the House Scott Bedke and Democrat Terry Pickens Manweiler, who's an attorney from Boise. There's a third candidate in the race, a person from Emmett who was formerly known as Marvin Richardson, but changed his name to Pro-Life, is also on the ballot as a Constitution Party. Pro-Life is another one of those candidates who kind of habitually runs for office every 2 years, and he didn't meet the debate threshold for having an active campaign. So the two front runners are Republican Scott Bedke, who's very much running on his experience. And I know Scott's written about this, but Scott Bedke is a Republican. He's the longest serving Speaker of the House in Idaho history. And he's running for lieutenant governor. And that might sound a little funny, like, why would the Speaker of the House run for lieutenant governor? But we've seen a number of times in the last 20 years, candidates and elected officials using the lieutenant governor's office as a launching pad to higher office, mm-hmm. either to run for governor in a later election or maybe run for Congress at a later election. And so Scott Bedke is running on his experience. The Democratic challenger, Terry Pickens Manweiler, who is a partner and started her own law firm in downtown Boise, she's running to shake things up and to push back against the legislature. She's concerned about Idaho's near total abortion ban and about what will happen in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning the Roe v. Wade decision. And so she's running to provide some accountability and push back against the Republican-controlled Idaho legislature. And I asked Terry Pickens Manweiler how she would do that, because the lieutenant governor, it's an interesting job in Idaho. It's a part-time position. The responsibilities are really, really limited. It's only really the job calls for presiding over the Senate. But even then, the lieutenant governor only votes when there is a tie on the Senate floor. So I asked Terry Pickens Manweiler how she could do that, how she could push back against Republicans in the legislature. And she pointed to outgoing Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan and said, in the ways that Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan used the office of Lieutenant Governor to push the state to the right, Terry Pickens Manweiler said she would try to harness that same power to instead hold the legislature accountable and push back against them. And so that's interesting. But I know Scott has written about this race, and I'd love Scott's thoughts on the difference between the two candidates and kind of what's at stake in this election.
Yeah, I think you're right, Clark. I think that Scott Bedke as lieutenant governor might be a stepping stone for a higher office. I think Terry Pickens Manweiler is running a very vigorous campaign, and she's very hopeful for victory. She feels, particularly in the wake of Roe v. Wade, and points out, rightly so, that Scott Bedke, as Speaker of the House, presided over and took votes on those very restrictive abortion laws in Idaho. And so while some may see Scott Bedke as a moderate and would welcome that moderating force, Terry Pickens Manweiler points out that, well, he has kowtowed many times to the extreme right in his party, and her voice is necessary in that office, if nothing else other than a bully pulpit, to pull the state, or at least the executive branch, over to the left a little bit to counterbalance some of the far right extremism that's going on.
But I was also going to say, Terry Pickens Manweiler said that she holds Scott Bedke accountable for the state of Idaho not adding the words, not adding sexual orientation and gender identity to the Idaho Human Rights Act. She said this is the longest serving Speaker of the House. He has a ton of legislative clout, and all of the efforts for that over the years were met with resistance at the legislature. And so that's another area, along with reproductive rights and abortion rights, that that Terry Pickens Manweiler is going after Scott Bedke there. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's okay, Clark. I appreciate that. So, Nicole, you recently wrote an article about how the Forest Service actually sprayed chemicals on private property. Is this something they normally do?
Yes. Yeah, so this story focused on some homes in the North Fork area, which is a small town near Salmon. The Salmon Chalice National Forest has had a multi-year effort to spray some herbicides to cut down on cheatgrass, which I'm sure most of us are familiar with. It's a pretty widespread nuisance invasive weed. It can cause all kinds of issues. I think a big one around like Boise is with pets. It can get in paws and whatnot and cause infections. And it's also just a pretty terrible source of nutrients for wildlife. So the Forest Service has been spraying up there in the Salmon Chalice National Forest to get some natural weeds back in the area for wildlife, and to cut down on cheatgrass is a pretty prolific accelerant for wildfire. So getting rid of it is theoretically supposed to make wildfire less bad in that area. So It's not, I wouldn't say it's forbidden or out of the question that they sometimes will spray on private properties. What they've been trying to do with this project is leave, according to their project plans, a 300-foot buffer between the forest-managed property and any adjacent private property. And they've been doing this project since, I believe, 2018. And the real issue kind of came to a head last year. They were spraying near a development in a drainage called Fourth of July Creek. And all of the, well, I guess I shouldn't say all, but several of the residents of that drainage said, you know, they weren't told that there was going to be any spraying happening. This was just over a little over a year ago, at the beginning of October 2021, and basically said they found out that there was going to be spraying by seeing helicopters flying over their homes and spraying herbicide, which they were not certain what this chemical was. How it was being applied. Several of the folks that live in that area are military veterans. One of them was a helicopter instructor pilot for the Army. And so it raised concerns for him that, you know, he didn't feel that it would be possible to fly a helicopter in the way it was being flown without the rotors creating some kind of backwash of herbicide onto property where the Forest Service didn't have permission to be spraying this herbicide. There are two other folks. There's one gentleman who fought in the Vietnam War and was exposed to Agent Orange and was very wary of what these chemicals were. And then another gentleman who fought in Afghanistan and was exposed to burn pits where troops were burning medical waste and other kinds of waste that has now been linked to some health issues. So a lot of the folks in that area were concerned about the herbicide. And Idaho State Department of Agriculture investigation did find that the herbicide did indeed make it onto private property. And kind of the real thorn in people's side over this was, you know, the Forest Service denied that any of their herbicide would have gotten on private property. They kind of pushed back at any of these claims, and residents were, they felt like they'd been tricked. I think that's kind of the crux here is less about, you know, the Forest Service kind of being egregious with where it was spraying and more about the fact that these folks felt like they had been kind of gaslit and told that what they saw had not happened, only to later find out through this Department of Agriculture investigation that they did in fact see herbicides being applied to their own property and in some cases potentially near or on areas where they were working without their permission.
Okay, gotcha. Caitlin, I want to wrap up. We've got just about a minute and a half left, but I love this next story. So Shelley High School over in Eastern Idaho apparently has what? The number two best mascot in the nation, a potato named Boomer?
Yes, exactly. So basically, this is a really fun story. There is a nationwide contest for best high school mascot on Scorebook Live, which is a news website for high school sports. And Shelley High School, their mascot is a russet potato that everybody calls Boomer. And nationwide, they're currently sitting at number two with 17.9% of the vote as of the time we wrote the article. And they had almost 21,000 votes. So you can go on their website to vote for them, Scorebook Live, and vote for the russet potato. I don't think there's like any kind of cash prize or anything, but it is so cool that somewhere over in Little East Idaho and Shelley is on such a big platform with Boomer the russet potato.
Well, and that's the thing. It's a small high school for people who are familiar with it. And I love that it's getting this recognition, and it's just, you know, it's Idaho potatoes. And yeah. And what the number one is, it's a school in Wisconsin, right?
Right. It's the Rylander Hodags in Wisconsin. So you have until November 1st at 9:59 PM to vote. It would be so cool if they won.
Absolutely, it would be. Well, what a great way to end the week. I really appreciate all of you. We've been talking with Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with Idaho Statesman, Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, and Nicole Blanchard, outdoor reporter for Idaho Statesman. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.